All right. Well, welcome, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us today. This is the Health and Human Services Finance Division. I'd like to call the division to order. And again, as we always do, we'll ask members to keep their feeds muted and raise their hand if they would like to ask a question, and staff will both put your hand down and put you on the list for having your for being able to ask your question or make your comment. So on our agenda today, we have a couple of items. Of course, this is an informational hearing. There won't be any votes today. We're not going to announce a quorum, but the legislative assistant for the committee, Ms. Niedernhofer, is noting the role just from the Zoom here. But we're here today to talk about a couple of items that are potentially going to be coming up in our special session. So let me just sort of set this up by reminding everyone that the money that came from the federal government for COVID relief, the what we've been calling the COVID relief fund that's been under the control of the administration, is only usable until the end of the year. And a lot of that money has been spent on pretty critical items over the course of the pandemic, and it is going to end. Unfortunately, the pandemic is not ending with it. So we have some pretty important items. At least this is, of course, my opinion. I hope that you'll share it, especially after you hear more in this hearing. But there are some very critical items that we need to continue with state funding while we wait for the federal government to step up and come in and fill the gap again. And I'm following as I can on the news about what's going on there. But the bottom line is that if we don't put forward from some state money right now, it may be that some very critical items and some very critical activities in response to the pandemic will have to end. So that's what we're trying to work on right now, is moving some of these things forward. And we have been talking with our counterparts in the Senate about these items, and they are, I cannot say that they're all agreed to, but you'll hear a little bit more about that perhaps, but with some continuing work, we hope to move these items forward. So with that, we're going to start with Representative Howard. He is going to carry the legislation on homelessness. And so I'm going to call on Representative Howard to kick us off on that item. And of course, the language has been sent out to everyone, and I hope that that is something you've been able to look at. So Representative Howard, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to quickly turn this over to folks at the agency to discuss this, but just a little table setting. Keeping our most vulnerable Minnesotans safe keeps all Minnesotans safe, and that's really the heart of what the legislation that we're going to be discussing here today is all about our collective efforts of many during this pandemic to care for our most vulnerable. And it might seem like ages and ages ago, but back in March of this year, Representative Liebling, Representative Cantrell, and others worked on a bipartisan basis to pass needed funding to make sure that our most vulnerable population was safe, and that we had a strong strategic plan to make sure that, you know, if somebody is unsheltered and they get sick, there is a safe place for them to isolate, and that we're looking at our entire continuum of housing to make sure that folks can stay safe. And when we passed those funds, I don't think anybody had an idea how long this pandemic would last. The funds were needed then because of the pandemic. And now today we know for certain they're very needed. With COVID surging, we absolutely need to continue providing these resources. And as Representative Liebling mentioned, in this moment, we really don't have a choice but to make sure that we provide these resources and a bridge into 2021. Hopefully there are better times ahead, but at this moment, to make sure that we keep our most vulnerable Minnesotans safe, this is really important funding. And I think I'll turn it over to Kathy Tenbrook to discuss more in detail the proposal that we're discussing, its importance and its need.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Howard. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm delighted to be here. I'm Kathy Tenbrook. I'm an assistant commissioner and the executive director of our state's Interagency Council on Homelessness. And I know my time with you is short to tee all of this up, so I will be as brief as I possibly can. But to set the stage for this package of what really are three interconnected proposals, I'd like to offer just a few quick pieces of data. First, on any given night, there are at least 8,000 Minnesotans who are experiencing homelessness. This is based on our annual one-night count we do every January. So that was the count pre-COVID. About half of all people experiencing homelessness in our state are families with children. 25% of everyone who's homeless throughout the state of Minnesota is actually without even a shelter bed, meaning that they are sleeping outside, they're in cars or fish houses or other places not meant for human habitation. And this number has been rising for several years in a row. And 35 to 40% of all people who are homeless in our state are actually in greater Minnesota. People certainly often think about homelessness and the metro area, but in fact, homelessness impacts every corner of our state, and our fastest rate of growth in unsheltered homelessness, so people sleeping outside, between 2019 and 2020 was actually in greater Minnesota. And so people are often surprised by that. And I say all of this just to help the committee understand both the scale of the need, as well as the focus of our COVID-specific homelessness work, which has really broad geographic reach. The funds we have utilized since March have gone to 154 distinct entities, including 40 cities and counties and 18 tribal governments or American Indian service providers. And since COVID struck in March, the support from the legislature and the influx of federal resources have protected thousands of people experiencing homelessness by creating about 2,800 additional spaces, including the staffing and the food and the protective equipment, primarily through a hotel and motel model in partnership with the hospitality industry and communities in both greater Minnesota and the metro area. And has also moved people with the greatest risk of very poor outcomes into places where they could be more physically distanced from others. So in other words, out of really congregate, crowded shelter settings into hotel rooms and other spaces if they were most at risk of severe outcomes from getting COVID. Many people experiencing homelessness are at really great risk to COVID due to advanced age, very significant underlying health conditions, and because of the very settings that people find themselves in, crowded congregate spaces or places with lack of sanitation and hygiene. These efforts since March have also created safe spaces for people to isolate if they were COVID positive or they were symptomatic and awaiting test results. They weren't sick enough necessarily to go to the hospital, but they needed somewhere safe to be that was away from other people. And so these resources also helped create these isolation spaces to allow time and space and support to heal without going into the overburdened healthcare system, but also protecting the broader community as well. The homelessness package in front of you today is a request to help really avoid that cliff that we see coming in just a few short weeks when the CRF funds end. This bill would really be a stopgap in funding, primarily to sustain all that we've been able to establish across the state and help us sustain that through the end of February, when we are hopeful that more federal assistance would be available. We are at a really critical moment in this fight against COVID. As I know you all know all too well, cases continue to rise. They're also rising among people experiencing homelessness. We now have over 500 people experiencing homelessness that have tested positive for COVID, and those numbers are continuing to go up. And decisions need to be made really right now with hotel partners and service providers all around the state, whether or not we're going to be able to continue or terminate, frankly, our contracts with them. So this package does three really important things. It protects people who are very, very at risk of bad outcomes. It provides support to an overloaded hospital system to keep people who don't need to be in the hospital out of the hospital. People experiencing homelessness from all the data since March, we've looked at that and it has shown us that they are 5.5 times more likely to end up in the hospital if they do get sick than the general population. So really important to protect those folks and keep them out of the hospital when that's not the needed place to be. And sustained support for the struggling hotel and food industries that have been really terrific partners with us in this effort since the beginning. So the three pieces, first of all, the emergency services program, it's for $9 million to sustain the spaces I mentioned, the staffing, the hygiene, the food, the PPE through the end of February. And I can tell you without that funding, many of these efforts will either have to shut down completely, or if they do continue, we'll have to continue without some really critical COVID supports like the PPE, the food, the hazard staff pay. The second piece of the proposals that we've brought forward is for isolation spaces, and this is for $4.3 million to support people who are COVID positive or symptomatic and awaiting results, just as I mentioned, and don't have a safe place to stay. It doesn't preclude serving people other than people experiencing homelessness. That is certainly the group it is supporting the most because they are the ones least likely to have a safe place to be. But there are other people maybe in overcrowded housing conditions and other situations that may also need that isolation space as well. And these settings are really designed to have a stay of anywhere between 10 and 14 days. Right now, the capacity we have in terms of isolation is about 380 people at any one point in time. These are spaces we've set up in Anoka, Beltrami, Hennepin, Ramsey, and St. Louis counties. They include spaces that the state has funded, but also spaces that local governments have used their CARES Act dollars to stand up as well. And since March, they've all supported about 975 people who were in those circumstances. This request would sustain those existing spaces the state has already helped stand up. It would support Hennepin County and Ramsey County to sustain their spaces. They have stood up a lot of isolation space that is also at risk of the same federal funding cliff. And it would allow for resources through the end of February, assuming we still see the spike in cases and outbreaks, so that we could provide additional space as well. Up to another 134 rooms would be available with that additional money. Without this funding, for this piece of the response, we risk losing these spaces and having infectious people staying in crowded congregate spaces, moving around and infecting the broader community, and needing access to hospital care. So that is the two parts of our three-legged stool that we wanted to talk to you about. And I know Christine Davis from DHS is here to talk about the third piece, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. Christine Davis, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Christine Davis, I supervise the housing support program at the Department of Human Services. And as background, the housing support program provides funding for room and board and related supports for a little more than 21,000 people each month across the state. And housing support providers serve adults with disabilities and older adults, and the goal is to prevent and end homelessness and institutionalization. In order to receive housing support, people must live in approved types of settings, and the most common are adult foster care, supportive housing for people exiting homelessness, assisted living, and other group facilities like board and lodges and boarding care homes. Housing support is an important part of the continuum of resources that respond to, prevent, and end homelessness in Minnesota. By definition, people who receive housing support, as well as the settings where people reside, are at high risk for COVID-19. As a result, last March, the legislature authorized a temporary increase to the state housing support payments for the months of March, April, and May to help providers maintain room and board for residents and follow federal and state health and safety guidance for COVID-19. Using our existing infrastructure, DHS was able to distribute funds in monthly installments to about 2,000 provider agencies serving 23,000 people across those 3 months in 7,000 settings. Providers reported that these funds had high impact during those months to keep residents and staff safe, to maintain staffing levels for care, and to keep people housed. Now, as we find ourselves again in uncharted territory with surges in COVID infections heading into winter, we see another opportunity to use this unique infrastructure we have with broad reach to shore up the health and safety for residents and staff across many high-risk settings. This request would provide a temporary increase of about 10.7% to the current room and board rate, or around $100 per person, for housing support recipients served in the months of January and February 2021, totaling around 4.2 million. Again, these funds will support provider capacity to help keep people safe and maintain levels of care and keep people in housing.
Okay, thank you for that. Next on the list to testify is Beth DeVarken. Hope I'm saying that right. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee. My name is Bethany DeVakarin, or Beth DeVakarin, and I work as a public health nurse for Healthcare for the Homeless in Hennepin County. So we serve adults and families that are experiencing homelessness in Minneapolis, both in the shelter system, those who are sleeping outside, and also now in these hotel settings. And I'm just happy to be here to share a bit of my experiences working directly with our population. As a nurse working with those experiencing homelessness, I can really attest to what's already been said about the risk of COVID-19 for our clients. We know that folks experiencing homelessness are at the highest vulnerability to contracting the illness, passing it on to others, and also having poor health outcomes because of COVID. For reasons already stated, our clients, they don't have homes in which to stay to prevent illness. They don't have homes to stay if they are sick, to isolate. Many people are staying in congregate living settings. And we know that those experiencing homelessness in general are more likely to have co-occurring chronic diseases that are of concern when we're talking about a pandemic. I can also attest to the work that's being done in shelters to mitigate these risks as much as possible. Shelters have expanded their services as much as possible, which requires an increase in staffing being present during the day. And at least in, this was in direct response to other community resources that our patients rely on for getting their daily needs being met, having to shut their doors. So shelters had to step up to provide more services. In collaboration with public health officials, shelter staff have worked hard to increase social distancing in shelters, to implement new cleaning procedures. Healthcare for the Homeless, we've been involved in doing mass testing at shelters and surveillance of positive cases at these sites. And as was already mentioned, the most vulnerable adults have been moved out of shelter into these hotel spaces. So I'm seeing on the ground the clients and the staff who are benefiting from this funding. I am certain that the measures that have been taken have saved lives in our population, both by preventing cases, by minimizing the spread to other people, and to keeping people out of the hospital. This work has most definitely required resources above what shelters normally need to operate, and I think maintaining those funds is critical. And especially true now, as we're seeing that cases are continuing to surge and hospitals are full at this point. And I'll just add, even beyond the emergency funding on the table right now, I think that we need to continue to talk about being forward thinking and having an ongoing strategy for addressing the needs of those experiencing homelessness, such as with a bill that Healthcare for the Homeless has been and other healthcare agencies have been working on that will advocate for recuperative care in the shelter settings in 2021. But for now, we urge and we thank you for your support for the emergency funds for shelters that are being discussed now and for your future support for our clients who are experiencing homelessness. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for being here today. We have now Sandy Henham. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Sandy Henham, and I work for Village of Hope. And Village of Hope is an emergency shelter for families experiencing homelessness in Bemidji. And I'm here to advocate for the Homes for All request for shelter through the emergency services program Isolation Spaces, the support we really all need to get us through these winter months. With tears in her eyes, Amy told me over the phone, "I don't know what I'll do if you can't help me. You are my last hope." And there are many, many people like Amy that we hear from every day. People who are struggling to stay safe in a world that's already overwhelming. Now you add COVID to the mix, and it's really devastating. She'd been on the phone for a few hours, trying her best to get support for her family that needed to get out of a crowded situation due to a COVID positive test. So because of these funds, we were able to put her in a hotel. Our case manager worked with her, and we found her housing in 3 weeks. This is some of the work that your ESP dollars do in a community. These dollars have protected a community that is already clinging to mental and physical health by a thread. By allowing us to use hotels for isolating, making our shelter safer with changes such as twin beds rather than queen beds, you are helping us make the world a safer place. Lots of small changes make a big difference in the fight against COVID. However, some shelters do need bigger changes. Without these ongoing funds, there is no money to keep going. As humans fighting to keep people healthy, we are exhausted. But a future for all of us continues. Even in a pandemic, we are making a difference in the lives of families in northern Minnesota. Our shelter is saving lives, and housing does end homelessness. Thank you again, Chair Liebing, and the committee members for this opportunity. And I appreciate your partnership, and I hope you support the Homes for All request.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony and also for your work. We really appreciate that. I have one member with a question, Representative Jordan.
Not so much a question. I guess I do have a question. I really want to thank Representative Howard and everyone who's spoken today for this bill. You know, my district in Northeast Minneapolis is not unique in the state of Minnesota, and that we've had many unsheltered neighbors who have really struggled during COVID to find safe housing, and I've had many parks become home to people looking for safe places because they know there is just not the same kind of safety that the state can provide. So I really want to thank everyone for being aware of this. That being said, we know we need an urgent need now. I was just wondering how soon, if we were able to pass this in a special session, we could start to see more beds come online across the state for our unsheltered neighbors.
That's a great question. Who could answer that? Is Kathy Tenbrook still?
Deputy Commissioner Tenbrook could answer that.
There we go.
Everybody, thank you, Representative, for that question. I think, you know, of course, what I would love to say is that these dollars will create hundreds of additional spaces of capacity. And I unfortunately have to tell you that this is, frankly, a minimum ask to mostly simply sustain the system that we have set up since March. And so the $9 million in the ESP, for example, will really, that's our very best estimate based on actual spending rates per month of what we have in place now. With that said, the isolation space request does include a little bit of additional resource, assuming that we may see some additional cases in shelters or additional outbreaks, and that could create some additional isolation space capacity to protect people as well.
Thank you. Representative Jordan, did that answer?
Yes, that was very helpful, Madam Chair. I would like to see, if possible, anything that the state can do to make sure that we are providing more beds because we know the need is there. And I think Sandy said it really well when she said that housing can help end homelessness. So I think that's something that this committee, I guess maybe not this committee, but future committees should really look at making sure we can find that funding. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And of course, we will have, when we look at our new committee structure, we're going to have even more emphasis on that this coming session. But I do want to emphasize that what we're doing right now are kind of the, what we consider kind of the minimum for a special session, because these are urgent things that can't wait till the regular session, till the next budget. And we do have this funding cliff that's happening with the federal dollars and with Congress being pretty dysfunctional, apparently, and not being able to come through with funds to just keep things going when we are in absolutely the worst part of the pandemic right now. So on the list, I have Representative Cantrell and then Representative Grunhagen. And please raise your hand if you'd like to be on the list. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I just wanted to make a quick statement about, you know, thank you, Representative Howard, for bringing this bill forward into the testifiers. This is absolutely critical funding, and it is vital that we continue kind of the work that was done back in March to try to structure as much stability for unhoused Minnesotans and Minnesotans struggling with housing instability throughout this pandemic, given especially that our unhoused Minnesotans are at heightened risk of COVID, and especially in the winter months as temperatures begin to drop. So I really just wanted to say, you know, thank you, Representative Howard, for bringing this forward. I do hope to see its passage so that we can ensure that no Minnesotans are left behind in our effort to ensure that we're keeping as many folks safe as possible. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a couple questions to whoever can answer them. So the money, if we'd approve this, and then we get, it looks like we're expecting federal money by the end of February, sometime in February. So would this backfill what we've spent? We know we have a surplus, what, $670 million? That's off the top of my head. But in the next biennium, we're looking at a $1.2 to $1.3 billion deficit already. And so is there a provision to, if we get the federal money, which I do think they'll come through eventually, I'm over 50% sure of that, although that might be misplaced. would it backfill what we're spending? Because I assume this money is coming out of the general fund.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. This is general fund money for sure. And let's see, is Dave Greenman maybe, or Matt Burdick, who would like to respond to that question about backfilling state funds?
Hi, Chair Liebling, Matt Burdick from DHS. Unfortunately, we don't have our budget team here available at this point, so we'll have to follow up with the committee on how that's working. I understand there's a lot of moving parts between the state and federal dollars, so we'll get back to you in short order on that. Apologies.
So, okay, thank you, Mr. Burdick. And so let me just say, Representative Grunhagen, this is an issue that I have raised with the administration. And so has my counterpart in the Senate, Senator Benson. And we're pretty of a mind on this. We'd like to see that happen. Now, that being said, we don't know what the federal funds are going to be, and we don't know how they might be limited or designated. But if they do go back to the ending of the previous funds, and there is money available for these kinds of activities, we would very much like to see a backfilling of these funds. But I don't think we can assume that. However, I'm really grateful that we have a better forecast than was expected, because with Minnesotans in the precarious position that they're in because of the pandemic, it strikes me that whether we backfill these funds or not, this is something that we need to do for our people to help them get through to the end of the pandemic, which thankfully is in sight with the vaccine coming. But it may be a few months yet before that's really effective enough that we can say the pandemic is over. So, Representative Grunhagen, please.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for talking with Senator Michelle Benson on that issue. The obviously, we want to help the homeless, okay? I spent most of my life trying to help people floating down the river of life, hurting and having problems. I don't need to go over that. But both in my insurance agency and Hale Ministry and school and everything else. But, and I was glad to do it. But and I did it on a voluntary basis, by the way. I didn't get paid, just if you want to make that note. But, you know, the I guess it'd be nice to make a reduction some if we don't know if this is going to be backfilled. And again, we're not sure we're going to get the funding for sure. It'd be nice to make a reduction of the spending in some other area of the budget. You know, maybe we could suspend construction on Southwest Light Rail. Just a thought. But anyway, my understanding is that the Senate is trying to do that, find reduction someplace else. And I think with the fiscal situation that we're faced with, especially in the upcoming biennium, the prudent thing to do is to fully vet that idea and see if we can't come up with some type of reduction someplace else, if at all possible. Has any efforts been made along that line as far as the House is concerned? Chair Lieber?
Well, Representative Gruenhagen, those, as you may imagine, those kinds of discussions are out of the purview of this committee, and I'm not on the larger negotiating team of what the whole balance is going to look like. So okay. I can't really answer that. But what I would say is that the current, you know, I've been listening carefully to the forecast. I'm on the Ways and Means Committee. I listen to what the experts tell us, what MMB tells us, how they explain how they're projecting the budget. And one thing that is really certain in this budget is how much uncertainty there is.
Yeah.
But one thing that I think is very certain is that the pandemic is still upon us and that we're going to see a lot more toll of death and of illness. And that there are a lot of unknowns about how people may be affected over the long term from getting COVID, even if they don't have major symptoms when they get it. So, you know, given that we can't predict the future very well, and this forecast that we have, this so-called surplus now of $600 and some million, this is just to the end of this fiscal year, right?
Yep.
I think these, whether or not there's any savings to be found anywhere, honestly, some of the projected surplus is based on some lower spending, not just additional revenues coming in, but a lot of lower spending. And frankly, a lot of that is in HHS.
Yep.
Because lower utilization and so on. So I think that whether or not there's, you know, I just think this is important. And we have the money. And this is a place that I think, for me personally, it's a priority to spend it in this area. So, I mean, I don't want us to go on with this because it is kind of out of the scope of our committee here, but that's just my feeling. Please.
Yeah, I got one more other question, another area. You know, I complimented the governor, I think about a year ago, you probably remember that, on his ability to raise funds from the private sector to help with the homeless situation. I think you remember that, right? The governor went out and raised so many millions of dollars to help from corporations primarily, I believe, if I remember right, to help with the homeless situation, especially in the metro area. And I forget the amount he raised, but it was several million dollars. And I did compliment him on that in the committee. On all these facilities that work with the homeless, can corporations or individuals make tax deductible contributions to help out with this effort in their local community or in the metro area? And is there any effort to ask the corporate area or Minnesota Chamber of Commerce or the business partnership to request that type of assistance? Does anybody know?
So Representative Gruenhagen, I mean, I see that Ms. Tenbrook maybe can answer, but so I would just say this. Contributions to nonprofits are as deductible as they always were. So if anybody wanted to do that, they certainly can. And I don't doubt that people are. But the other piece of this is really outside the scope of this committee. I think that, you know, we're here to talk about funding that we need as a state to put toward these issues. And, you know, if people can go out and raise other funding to do other things, that's fine, but that's kind of outside the scope. I don't know if Kathy Tenbroek wanted to add anything to that.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Just one small point I wanted to make, Representative, thanks for your question. We do have ongoing partnership with philanthropic leaders across the state and private sector investors in the work that we do. It's absolutely a partnership. And you're right, the partnership last winter that helped create some additional winter shelter beds was a really good example of that. But that's an ongoing part of our work, for sure.
I know the governor's busy, but you might want to ask him for a little help again. He did a good job last time.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Gronhagen. So, Representative Howard, any closing remarks here before we go on to our next issue?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers and for the brief conversation we've had today. And I think what comes through in the testimony is that the prudent decision on a bipartisan basis to secure these funds has saved lives. And that was made back in March when the virus was just in its beginning stages. So it just stands to reason with the virus surging, we wouldn't let Minnesotans who are our most vulnerable, who are homeless, fall off a cliff. This is, as Representative Liebling said, very necessary very efficient use of public dollars as well to make sure that we're saving lives, saving capacity in our healthcare spaces, et cetera. And I'm hopeful that as we were able to do in March, we're able to move forward on a bipartisan basis to protect our most vulnerable and keep all of Minnesotans safer in this pandemic. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Howard. So thank you, members. We will move on then to the next item on our agenda. And I should say the other item on our agenda, since we only have these two items. And this is one that I've been working on. And the name of it is Long-Term Care COVID-19 Funding Provisions. And you should have received the language that we've been working on this package as well. But so I'm going to... Let me just give a bit of background on this. So once again, these are items for the most part that have been funded with the CARES Act money that's been coming in. And again, the what we're looking at here is a cliff at the end of the year where the CARES Act funding stops. And of course, we're in what appears to be about as bad a phase of the pandemic as we've ever seen. And so this next proposal has to do with keeping our long-term care facilities safe. And this is something that has been worked on. The Department of Health has, and the Department of Human Services have worked on these issues. And now it looks like, because Congress hasn't acted, we're still in the pandemic, but our funding is going to stop. And so once again, this is temporary funding to fill the gap in hopefully to get us to more federal funding. And hopefully too, that we're going to start to see with the vaccinations coming in that soon enough, we'll start to get some relief from the pandemic. But I think this is absolutely critical funding to keep our long-term care facilities safe. And or as safe as they can be. We know they're not entirely safe, but you know, a lot of work has been done and continues to be done. So I'm going to call on Diane Rydrick, who is the acting assistant commissioner of the Department of Health, and ask her to talk through these provisions. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Diane Rydrick. I'm the Acting Assistant Commissioner of the Health Systems Bureau at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you for having us here today to walk through the bill and to discuss any questions that you have. In the interest of time, I'll try and keep my comments as short as I can, but I'm prepared to answer any questions that you might have. You know, Chair Liebling laid out the urgency for this well. Long-term care residents are among our most vulnerable populations in terms of the impact of COVID. Many facilities, despite their best efforts, have dealt with severe outbreaks among their staff and residents, and many of them have dealt with the resulting staffing shortages, especially in recent weeks, because the level of community spread has grown to the point where these carefully built flood walls have been breached, and even facilities that have been able to keep COVID out to this point are experiencing that impact now. And so we are seeing numbers of cases in long-term care that are at or above where we were at the peak back in the spring, even though we've been able to really hold it off over the course of the summer. We provide a wide range of supports for long-term care providers and residents. We've built an infrastructure to give them access to timely testing for their staff and for their residents. We make sure that they have support to implement robust infection prevention and control best practices, and that they have access to relief staffing when they are in staffing crisis related to either positive COVID tests among their staff or COVID exposures that keep people out of work for a 14-day period. And as Chair Liebling noted, these activities are supported by federal coronavirus relief fund dollars, which expire on December 30th. So I know that we are all feeling some optimism about a potential light at the end of the tunnel related to the pending availability of vaccines. And we are pleased that long-term care residents and staff, especially nursing home residents and staff, are in group 1A for vaccines. But we know that these needs are going to continue far into the new year, both because the vaccine is going to take time to, you know, with multiple doses and just the logistics of administering it within long-term care and just the ongoing spread of the virus. We know that we're still going to have these needs well into the new year after this funding expires. And we know that we're going to still have to do everything that we can to keep long-term care residents and staff safe. So this request provides bridge funding to allow us to continue providing these supports, almost all of which, with one exception that I'll note, are already in place through the first couple of months of 2021. So the bill includes funding for six buckets of activities, and five of the six are things that are already happening and have been in place for a number of months. And I will walk through through five of them briefly, and then I'll turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Pollack to describe the sixth. The first is continuing to provide on-site specimen collection and testing coordination using contracts with health system teams and temporary staffing companies. Right now, those teams provide specimen collections on-site in long-term care facilities around the state for around 100 facilities per week. It's been as high as 120 or more in some weeks, and they often swab in excess of 10,000 people in a week. That portion of the request also supports the cost of the staff in the State Emergency Operations Center who manage and coordinate this process and schedule the teams and make sure that they're connected to the testing supplies that they need. The second item is continuing to do testing of MDH staff who, as a requirement of their job, go into long-term care facilities. So these would be staff in the Health Regulation Division who go on site in long-term care facilities to do surveys or inspections or to provide infection control support. They are currently being tested twice a week using saliva tests, and that cadence of testing is consistent with what CMS requires for nursing home staff. The requirement for CMS for nursing home staff ranges from once a month to twice a week, depending on county level positivity. And because our staff may be in different facilities in different parts of the state, we're testing them at the highest frequency just to make sure that we are not a vector for COVID into a facility. The third item is continuing to support a contract for a nurse triage line, which reports COVID results to certain long-term care facility staff and residents and takes their questions about their test results. We use the nurse triage line in situations where a facility is using a standing order that we've developed, wherein MDH's Dr. Linfield, our chief medical officer, serves as the ordering provider. And in those cases, we use the triage line to report the results. The fourth item is continuing to support salaries for long-term care COVID infection control nurses who function as case managers for long-term care facilities. They work with facilities to provide TA and to help them implement testing and infection control guidance, and then also salaries for healthcare worker interview staff who work with facilities and with healthcare workers who have been exposed or who have tested positive to make sure that the appropriate exclusion policies are applied and to understand where the risks are around their exposure and anyone else who they may have exposed. The one new activity that is covered here is creating 4 strike teams, which are multidisciplinary on-site teams who support facilities that are experiencing a COVID outbreak. These are teams that include infection preventionists, a crisis staffing manager, a testing liaison, and an epidemiologist. They go on-site and can provide training and guidance and assessment of infection control practices and just be there as a hands-on team to help them manage that outbreak beyond the supports that we are already providing in a staffing crisis or when a facility needs testing. So it's a way to bring in really intensive supports to a facility that needs it and help them through that outbreak. The final activity that's in the bill is the Emergency Temporary Staffing Bill. That is also an existing activity. It is being led by the Department of Human Services. So I will turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Pollack to provide a brief overview of that. And then I think either of us can stand for questions about either any of the portions of the bill. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Pollack. Welcome.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for having me. I'm going to specifically talk about Section 2 on page 2, which is the general fund appropriation for the emergency staffing pool. this is a pool that has already come into existence using COVID Relief Fund, as you heard. We developed this concept last summer and began briefing chairs and the LCRC and the LC and the LAC about it last summer. It started operations in late September when we initiated our first vendor contract, and it has currently received about $9 million in COVID Relief Fund appropriations. And so we are doing this work now. The $2 million to extend the activity beyond December 30th, I do think is really important. The way this pool works is basically to contract with third-party staffing agencies to provide three levels of credentialed personnel. So it could be RN, LPN, or unlicensed CNA or direct support staff. And this can be personnel that are deployed to one of any number of facility types. So on page 3, you see a list that aligns with the list of our scope for the COVID Relief Fund response. Literally 24 different provider types and entities. So this is much broader than just nursing home and assisted living. This really tries to offer the temporary staff resource to a wide variety of the providers that are part of our congregate care delivery system, many of which have experienced COVID staffing crises by virtue of testing or hearing from staff as we've seen more community spread. Thus far, I think the program has had, some success. It does still struggle to find enough staff to meet the demand. There really are incredible number of, I think, almost 150 different facilities that have requested help from this program already because there is so much, COVID happening. And so we definitely see a very strong need for this into the next year in January and February. Our hope is that getting this general fund appropriation will allow a seamless transition into the new year and we would be able to continue offering this. The only other piece I wanted to add is that we do use a triage process with DHS and MDH employees who are subject matter experts. They review each request. We do not automatically grant emergency staffing resources. Each provider that contacts the SEOC has walked through some steps and some considerations of tactics and procedures they can use to avoid a staffing crisis and to evaluate whether they truly do need the staffing pool. And then once they go through that process, we do try to get the staff out there as soon as we can. The concerns that we had heard initially from our provider partners, they were worried that this might pull permanent staff off of the front lines and they would want to be in the staffing pool where you do earn higher wages, hazard pay level wages. That really hasn't been a problem. It's actually been the opposite. We've really had a hard time finding enough people for the staffing pool. And I think the permanent employees would rather keep permanent employment for I think a lot of obvious reasons. So that's a brief overview of the program, but I'm happy to take any questions or provide additional data.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Assistant Commissioner Pollack. And I don't have any members on the list with questions right now. I do want to say that just to remind members, they probably don't need reminding about the issue about staffing has been, even with before COVID, staffing in long-term care has been a concern. And of course, we raised funding for nursing homes not that many years ago, and that seems to have alleviated some of this. But it's not too hard to picture, and it probably isn't too hard for members to picture, what this could mean in a facility if suddenly staff are becoming ill or testing positive. And the risk to residents and the need to immediately get the staff out of those facilities, and then the crisis that can result in that from that if we don't have people in there in a nursing home or in another kind of long-term care setting where people are there and they live there and they can't just leave and they need care. So I just view this as an absolutely critical issue for us to be helping facilities. You know, we also have the concern that if employees test positive, you know, they also want to be able to continue working. I mean, nobody who's working wants to be excluded. People want to continue to work, but they can't. And in this legislation, we have also a provision about that they would continue to be paid as we're providing this free resource for the facility. We're backfilling staffing that they would continue to pay the staff that they have so that the, you know, being out sick with COVID or with a positive test is not going to, the pain of that shouldn't be landing on the employee. And it should, in fact, if people can step out without losing pay, then I would think that that would be helpful because they would be more likely to come forward if they do need to be isolated with COVID. So with my little delay there, I've gotten some questions so I can let some other people talk. We have Representative Kunisch and then Representative Bierman. Oh, wait a minute now. I think Representative Gernhagen is first. That looks that way to me. Sorry. Representative Gernhagen, go ahead, and then we'll have Kunisch and then Bierman.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the presentation. I read an article a while ago where the governor was, with this shortage of staffing due to COVID-19 or whatever, he was going to have National Guard members trained to fill in on an emergency basis. I actually thought that was a good idea, and I don't know where that's at, if that's is being implemented. Maybe the Assistant Commissioner probably can respond to that. But that was my recall on that. I actually thought that was a good idea by the governor, and because I know it is a crisis situation with the nursing homes right here. So yeah. I'll hang up.
Thanks for that question. Ms. Rydrick, is that yours?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Gernhagen, that one is to me. Yes, Representative Gernhagen, you're correct. The National Guard have been providing staffing support for a while now in a number of facilities. I don't have the number offhand. I want to say it's in the teens in terms of the number of facilities that they have provided support for. And they have been training more people, more troops to provide that support as nursing assistants. So generally, they will go out as part of a team, either alongside federal resources or just as a team of National Guard troops, and they will provide support on site for several days at a facility until we assess that their needs are met or they have enough staff coming back in to be able to address residents' needs. And we agree, it's been wonderful working with the Guard. They provided quite a bit of support on testing and did specimen collection for us for a number of months until we transitioned to other teams. And now they are really providing the core of one of the arms of staffing support that we're providing. And we are immensely appreciative of them for that.
Representative Gernhagen.
Oh, I just have one positive thing after the next to say about the governor today. And I have my share of disagreements with them, I'll tell you that. But anyway, I just think that's a good idea, and we should pursue that as much as possible. And I know these National Guardsmen have private lives too, and you know, there's a part-time job. But if they can help us get through this emergency, it would be greatly appreciated to the degree that some of them can. Okay, thank you. Thanks for the response.
Thank you. All right, Representative Kunesh.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and all of you. This has just been a really heartwarming conversation to know that there are hopefully opportunities coming down the pike for both our homeless communities and now our healthcare. My question actually was about what kind of support we were going to be able to provide to healthcare workers that do get ill, and if they would be continue to have the pay and the benefits while they were ill. Early on in this pandemic, I lost a father-in-law, and just recently a mother-in-law, not to COVID, but we saw firsthand the incredible care that the staff was providing not only to the residents, but to each other. We weren't able to visit my mother-in-law at all for months and months and months, but they, like we've heard the stories where they would bring iPads to connect with families and provide other ways to let those residents know that their family members were, you know, were there thinking about them and worrying about them. But it was also really important to recognize that the stringent protocol that they had for employees who were able to continue working in a healthy way, and how hard those employees worked to, from what I understand, to keep themselves in a really safe bubble so that they were able to take care of our loved ones. And if this is, if there's one way that we can show them that they have our support and our gratitude, I hope that we can do this, because I feel like every dollar that we invest or we put towards either our staffing or the supplies or the resources is going to pay off in the end, not only for a healthy community of our aged elders, but also the fact that we were able to show just how much we really cared about them. And it's a wonderful preventative measure, both in the homeless, in the previous bill for homelessness, and then for this one. So thank you both for bringing forward this bill, and thank you all that worked on this so much. It's very heartwarming.
Thank you, Representative Kunesh. Appreciate that. Representative Bierman, and then Haley. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me all right?
It's a little soft, but we can hear you.
A little soft? Yeah. Okay, I can speak up a little bit.
Perfect.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing all of this in this bill, this comprehensive program for our long-term care centers forward. It's very comprehensive, and I applaud the work, and I know that it's a need we have. My question maybe is for Assistant Commissioner Pollack. I'm just wondering, with the current funding that is available, how long that will hold out. I know this is to get us through just maybe a couple months in the next year, but are these continuations of these programs in jeopardy of ending before the 31st without funding? And I fully support all of these areas of funding. I think, as Rep. Kunesh Padin mentioned, this is what is going to save lives as we're, waiting for that vaccine to really kick in. So, but my question is, just how close to the end of the existing funding are we, and will this be enough?
Mr. Pollack.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, we are more than adequately funded for the month of December. The problem is that the COVID relief fund by law expires on December 30th. So those dollars cannot be used on January 1st if we had an emergency crisis staffing incident on or after December 30th. We wouldn't be able to use any of the COVID relief fund dollars. Those dollars are are not able to be expended after that date. So in order for the program and the response activity to continue, we do need this general fund appropriation. As far as $2 million being sufficient for the period through the end of February, we think it'll be adequate based on hopefully what the trend lines are with vaccination and some stabilization happening as the vaccination works its way through our frontline workers, who I do want to reiterate, just like Representative Kunesh said, I mean, we have absolute gratitude and thanks for people that are putting themselves in harm's way and providing the care in this manner. We think $2 million should be enough. The program is scalable. So what you appropriate, you know, we will spend as much as we can in terms of the workforce that we provide. And it's certainly possible that if, you know, unfortunately, if the vaccination doesn't get here quick enough, or if we have other delays for whatever reason, or if the pandemic gets worse, we could be in a position where we would, you know, we would have to triage. We would hit the maximum number of staff that you could buy for $2 million.
Representative Bierman.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. So I think this is a really important bill, and I hope that we can move this through this special session so that we are prepared and we're not losing all of these services that are needed. And they are just essential. So we're all going to have to talk about that during special session. Again, thank you, Chair Liebling, for bringing it through. And I would just also ask you to invite Representative Grunhagen to say any more good things about the governor today that he would like to spend time with.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have time at the end. We can have say good things about the governor period of time, you know, like sure. Let's share good things about the governor for 5 minutes. Anyway, no,
he
just
could,
kidding.
He could use some of that. He
yeah,
could use
probably.
Some.
So next on the list is Representative Haley.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it was a bipartisan moment, okay?
It's good. We don't have enough of those. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's nice to see all my colleagues today. We haven't been together for a while. I've been told there's kind of a gap between my speaking and my video today. So if that's happening, I'll turn off the video again, but wanted to say hello. So my question-
It looks just fine. It looks just fine, Representative
okay,
Haley.
Okay, if it's
so
working.
So far, so good.
I'm just trying to get inside the numbers a little bit, and I'm wondering if you could answer, looking at the amount of money we've spent already for temporary staffing, around $12 million, can somebody tell me how much staff that has paid for?
Great question. Let's see, who would like to answer that? Mr. Pollack, is that yours?
Sure, Madam Chair. Representative Haley, the data that you're looking at is the allocated amount from the COVID relief fund to this line item, to the staffing pool. And I don't believe it's 12 million. I believe it's been about 9 million thus far. I'm not sure if you're looking at something that was inclusive of other numbers. And so, you know, of that amount, we are under contract right now with two vendors. I think we've encumbered contracts with them for over $2 million. We have $7 million remaining, and we are about to sign contracts this week with three additional vendors that the Department of Administration added to the state master contractor list. It's really hard to predict whether we will spend that money exactly how and when we'll spend that money. Each of the vendors, you know, can charge us differential rates. We generally pay about $25 an hour for the unlicensed staff in terms of the compensation, about $35 for LPN, about $50 an hour for RN. But lately, there has been kind of a run on nurses. And by that, I mean, if you go on the internet right now with your RN degree and look for work as a traveling nurse in a hospital setting with COVID, you can receive pay of $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a week right now, because the staffing crisis is so bad in so many states simultaneously. So it's very hard for us to know exactly what we're going to end up paying for some of these response needs. And that's why we have that level of funding.
Representative okay. Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Pollack. I guess it is very hard to look at these numbers and determine again, just the how it's being spent. And your description right now that we still have 7 million in that fund, and I understand the difficulty in finding staff, and yet those funds run out at the end of December or we return them to the federal government, correct? That's CARES money that has to be spent, is that you said that earlier?
Madam Chair, Representative Haley, I don't know that it will be returned to the federal government. I think it may be reallocated to other costs that the state incurred, is my understanding of the way that the methodology works. So it's not impossible that it would be used for some other COVID-related use. But MMB has until, I believe, there was testimony in the other body on this topic earlier. So I don't want to speak for MMB, but there are other options that they could use the money for costs incurred related to the pandemic.
Representative Haley.
Okay. But we can't, if that money's going to, I guess I really want to, I'm trying to kind of follow the paper trail here, that we have money there that we can't use by the end of the year. And can that be allocated then for these costs? So if you maybe somebody can follow up with me on that. It sounds a little bit complex, but I would like to understand that answer.
Representative Haley, let me see if I can take a stab at it, and then Mr. Pollack can tell me if I'm off base or Ms. Rydrick. I think what we're talking about is that this is that CARES Act money that can only be used till December 30th. So even if we had buckets of it, the way that is structured under federal law is it's done at December 30th. So if Congress could get itself in gear and even extend the sunset, we'd be in a little different position, although much of that money has been used overall. So, but whether there's a little some extra left in one or another bucket, it's not going to, you know, I think MMB is going to try not to let us leave money on the table to the degree possible, because we also expended a lot of state money for some of these things. And many of us legislators would really like to see some backfilling of things that we put out general fund dollars for that might be able to be replaced with these federal dollars. But the bottom line is that this activity we're talking about, we will not have federal money for it on December 30th. So if we don't put state dollars out there, it will not be able to continue. I think that's my understanding. Is that correct, Mr. Pollack or Ms. Rydrick?
Chair Liebinger and Haley, and I'm sorry, I don't think I answered your initial question, which was how has it been used? You know, we have had over 140 facilities requesting assistance. We've approved them for about 500 shifts. Excuse me. Of those, I think we've been able to fill about half of them so far. So if you have constituents, if you have members of your community that are looking for work, we are still hiring and looking for people even today to fill shifts, you know, in various settings that I mentioned in the testimony.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I'll just follow up.
Sure.
And I guess it's getting at my point is the bigger budget picture that we're facing. May not be in your proposal, Madam Chair, but overall the discussion I think the legislature needs to have is these monies from the CARES Act, where are they being used for across the state for all of our needs? Because that impacts the decisions we make and how we spend the small, and as you pointed out, tenuous surplus that we have on paper today. We know the needs are going to be great through the winter and continuing to manage COVID. And so that's just maybe a broader statement of understanding where some of these monies get applied and how it affects our overall budget. If I can ask your indulgence, I was coming from another meeting before this call, so I was a little late, and I had a one question regarding testing.
Sure, that's related to this package, I believe. So please go ahead.
Yes. Okay. My understanding, and this is your first proposal, the testing in the long-term care facilities, which is very, very critical, and I support that. I want to understand the difference between the money that you're asking for, which the emergency operations centers test 10,000 a week. Overall, we test 60 some thousand in long-term care. So the other 60,000 is being managed how? And then where does the, because this, the cost for this section seems high compared to what I know we're spending on the overall number of testing 60,000 in long-term care a week.
Okay, Ms. Rydrick, that sounds like it might be one for you.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Haley. Yes, the testing that is coordinated by the SEOC is right now about 10,000 specimens per week. I think last week it was 12,000, so it does fluctuate a little bit as outbreaks do. And the funding that's requested here is to extend a set of contracts with different health systems and temporary organizations that provide the FTEs to go out on site and do that swabbing. It also supports the staff in the SEOC who schedule those teams, who coordinate with the labs, who make sure that supplies and couriers and other things get to and from where they need to be. You are correct. There is quite a bit more testing than that that goes on in long-term care. Our most recent estimates are somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 65,000 tests per week. That remainder that we are not coordinating is handled by the facilities themselves. So they work directly with a lab and they arrange for when they want the test kits to arrive. They have their own staff do the specimen collection and they have built those relationships with labs, which is really what we wanted to happen. We wanted the support that we provide through the SEOC to be there as a safety net to help facilities when they are unable to manage their testing needs, to be kind of a bridge to their ability to do it themselves. And when they are able to manage the testing themselves and work with the labs directly, they do so. And so the way that those other testing costs get paid, if it's an outbreak, the claims get submitted to insurance and insurance nearly always pays for them. We're not really hearing concerns about coverage for outbreak testing. If it's testing of staff once a week or twice a week, and I mentioned that that's a requirement of CMS, then the labs bill the facility directly and the facilities use generally their CARES Act funding to pay for that. And if they have expended all of that money, there are some options for them to seek reimbursement through DHS. So we provide that critical function sometimes just for facilities that are starting out on testing. Sometimes they come back to us when they're overwhelmed and need help and we will help them. But if they are able to manage it on their own, we encourage them to do that.
Representative Haley?
And again, I am not an expert in this area. So if there's an additional need for them, why wouldn't we put this money directly to that need to the long-term care facilities versus creating a different process with the State Emergency Operations Center?
Ms. Rydrick?
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative Haley, we are meeting a need with that support through the SEOC. We have worked closely with long-term care associations and with providers to build up that process and infrastructure because it's something that they have told us that they need. And so we've made sure that it's available to them and that we have sufficient capacity to do that. Those who are able to do it on their own do so, and we applaud that. So I don't really see it as setting up a separate process, more as maybe a scaffold or a support for those who need it until they're able to stand on their own and get the testing help that they need. But we stay closely connected with the providers on this, and they have continued to express that it's important to have that safety net of the SEOC supports to help them.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate the explanations. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Those are good questions, Representative Haley. No need to ever apologize for asking questions. If you don't know, probably a lot of us don't know. So thanks for paying attention to this stuff. And just, it does seem like, correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Rydrick, but it seems like what you're saying too is it's not only about being able to afford it, it's all of the kind of organizational issues that are involved in getting people in to do testing and getting the tests ordered. And then, of course, there's that piece that we always have to keep in mind that our insurance system may or may not be helpful because insurance will generally cover medically necessary testing. But where you're trying to do surveillance testing, they often won't cover it, right? Is that, that's part of this too, right, Ms. Rydrick? Or Please yes. correct me if I said anything that's not right.
Madam Chair, you are correct. I would say, too, what we have found sometimes is that facilities are managing their testing needs just fine until they're not. And sometimes an outbreak happens or a staffing crisis happens, and then they need help again because the same staff who are working 16-hour shifts or working doubles are then having to be pulled away from resident care to do testing. And that's just something that they maybe in normal times would be able to handle, but during an outbreak they can't. And so that's why I tend to think of this as more of a safety net for them in a way. So whether they're just starting out and doing testing for the first time, and some of them still are, or whether they need that help because they're in the midst of an outbreak, we are able to provide that for them and provide that relief. And you are correct, Madam Chair, generally insurance does not pay when the testing is surveillance testing, when it's workplace required testing, which is why for that weekly or twice a week staff testing, the guidance from CMS is that facilities should pay for it themselves because insurance is unlikely to cover that type of testing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. All right, are there other questions? I'm not seeing any. So this is, we are very hopeful of getting agreement on this package. And so, you know, we'll have to see what happens on this one, on the homelessness package that we discussed. But so special session has now been called for Monday afternoon. And if we can get agreement, we may be asking members to vote to suspend the rules so that we can move these packages through. And it may be one bill. I don't know how we're going to see it again, but I really appreciate everybody paying attention to this. Once again, I think this is a very critical function for us as legislators, for us as a state. The fact that Congress can't get its act together is really very unfortunate, but to the degree that we can, to the degree that we have funds available to help tide Minnesotans over and keep them as safe as we can until this thing is either over or we get more help from the federal government, I think it's a very high priority. So with that and seeing no other questions, I think that we are coming to the end of our time. We're ending a little bit earlier than we thought. And once again, I really appreciate everybody's time and attention to this. And please be in touch if you have further questions or concerns about any of it. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.